My castaway this week is a playwright. His elegant plots, scorching one-liners, and sympathetic characters have made him one of the most successful writers in American theatrical history. He was brought up in the Bronx during the Depression and began his career as a gag writer for radio and television. And then, in 1961, he wrote Come Blow Your Horn. It was an instant success, and since then, he's produced about one play a year. The titles read like a roll call of the popular and successful. Barefoot in the Park, The Odd Couple, Plaza Suite, as well as hit musicals such as Sweet Charity and They're Playing Our Song. I believe he said that if I keep on working, I'm going to unearth some kind of secret that will make it unnecessary for me to write again. He is Neil Simon. But after 29 plays, you're still searching, are you, Neil? The secret still eludes you.
Well, I don't think it's one secret anymore. I think new secrets come up. You do unearth some and find that there are others. So it goes on forever and you'll never really complete the cycle.
So you have to keep writing.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it'll stop sometime, either by my not being able to do it anymore, or worse still, losing my enthusiasm.
Of course, all your plays are humorous, even when the subject is deadly serious. Is that because you, as a private individual, always see the funny side of life, or is it simply how it comes out in the writing?
It's both. It comes out in the writing by itself. I'm not always looking for where it's going to be funny. It just seems to do that. But I do have sort of an oblique look at life. I see things askew, and the comedy comes out.
But what about you in your personal life, when you're in the middle of personal misery, which you've had, we've all had in our lives? Is there a kind of little voice inside your head that's seeing the funny side of it at the same time?
Well, it depends on the misery. I mean, some are too deep and cutting to need or be able to use that kind of humor. But I think when I'm funniest is when I'm in trouble. I remember a number of times I was stuck in an elevator, which I have claustrophobia, and that's the worst thing in the world for me, the worst fear. I was pretty funny in that elevator. It was a way to get over the horror of being in there.
When did you first realize that you could make people laugh? How early on in your life?
Very young, in my early teens, and the one I made laugh most was my brother. And after my brother came some of my friends. The humor changed over the years, but I had a very good friend who also had a good sense of humor, and it made us outsiders. We would go to a dance, for example, we were like 15 years old, and just make jokes about the whole evening, commenting on that girl or that fella. The trouble with it was we never got to dance with anyone. We didn't have as good a time as the other people had while we were making ourselves laugh.
Well, now what we do on this program is cast you away alone on a desert island, and we talk about the highs and the lows of your life as you go and the music that you'd like to have with you there. So tell me about your first piece.
The first piece is A Fugue from Tin Horns, which was the opening number in Guys and Dolls. And the first piece of music I thought was such an intricate and new sound in Broadway music, written by Frank Lesser. I know when you listen to it, it just is very catchy.
Paul Revere, now this is no bum steer. It's from a handicap, but that's real sincere.
I know it's Valentine, the morning works look fine. You know the jockey's brother's a friend of mine.
So make it epitaph, he went to buy a half, according to this here in the Telegraph. Epitaph,
Valentine,
I got the horse.
Fugue for Tin Horns, the opening song from the men's chorus of Guys and Dolls, and that was from the Broadway production. One of the most striking things about your work, Neil Simon, is, of course, its terrific titles. Barefoot in the Park, The Goodbye Girl, Lost in Yonkers. The Odd Couple is part of the English language now, isn't it? Did they take forever to think up? Did they take as long as the play does to write?
Not as long as the play, but I do spend a lot of time. But generally, when they come quickly, it means I know a lot about the play. When I have to stop and think of the title, it means I'm searching the play for a title.
But Barefoot in the Park, I mean, it's a wonderful title, and it came to symbolise the 60s somehow, didn't it? And,
yes.
But it was also part of your life. Your life is in your plays, in many of them, isn't it? Barefoot in the Park was about you and your first marriage.
My first wife.
And was she as zany and crazy as Jane Fonda was in that film?
Probably not that zany, but she did things that I thought were out of the ordinary and extraordinary, because she was so vital and so full of life. And at a time when it was still safe to walk in Washington Square Park, which is in the Greenwich Village part of New York City, we would walk our dog in the park at 3 o'clock in the morning and not think anything of it. And if it was a warm summer night, Joan would just take her shoes off and walk in the park, and I wouldn't do it. So she would call me sort of a stuffed shirt, something probably funnier than that.
What about The Odd Couple? Who were the inspiration for them?
The inspiration for The Odd Couple was my brother and an agent friend of his. They both had recently gotten divorced, and because they had to pay alimony to their wives, they decided to move in together to save expenses. And my brother was a fairly good cook, so when they went out on double dates, Danny would do the cooking. But when his friend, Roy, brought the girls in an hour late, or asked them to come an hour late, my brother was furious because the roast was overdone. And I had visited him on one of these occasions. I was living in New York and he was in California. And I said, this is a hysterical idea for a play.
But it was Danny, you said, your brother, who in the very early days pushed you on, pushed you out, said, Neil, you can do funny, you go and do it.
Yes.
How did
yes.
he know you could do it? Why was he so confident?
He just knew it. He said to me at the age of, I was probably 15 or 16, he said, one day you will be one of the, or not the, best comedy writer in America. Now, that's a pretty extraordinary statement to make to a 15-year-old boy who achieved a great deal of success. I think his encouragement helped me, but I'm not so sure if I would have done it on my own. I didn't know what I was headed for.
But life was pretty hard then, wasn't it, in your childhood? This was the Bronx through the Depression years. It was, I mean, the family was pretty poor, wasn't it?
Yes, I wrote more about that later on in Broadway Bound. Not only were we very poor during the Depression, but my mother and father had a very up-and-down marriage. They broke up maybe 6 or 7 times, and my father would move out. Very often, my brother and I would stay there and live with my mother. Sometimes we had to take in roomers or boarders. And oftentimes, we split up. At one time, my mother and I went to live with an aunt and uncle, which turned into another play, Brighton Beach Memoirs. My brother went to live with someone else. And I think humor was the best way for Danny and myself to deal with all of this. It kept us from really falling apart and going astray.
Hmm. Record number 2. Tell me about that.
Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. I thought of Rhapsody in Blue because it reminds me so much of New York and the story of how Rhapsody in Blue first got put on. It was at the Aeolian Hall. I have no idea where that is. And it was played by Paul Whiteman and his orchestra, and it sort of knocked New York on its ears. It had such a New York sound, and all of his early work did have a very New York sound.
Part of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, played by the Columbia Jazz Band, conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas. The hero of Biloxi Blues, Eugene Jerome, is a young Jewish boy doing his army training towards the end of the Second World War. How much of your life, Neil Simon, is in that piece? That's pure you, is it?
Oh, yes, it is. It just came to me piece by piece. I said, what's the first thing I remember about going into the army? And it was the train ride after the first few days at Fort Dix, New Jersey, where you were sworn in and you got your uniforms and they put you on a train. The war was still on. It was 1945 in August. and they had just dropped a bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we were on that train heading to Biloxi, Mississippi, in the deep south. And we had these fatigue uniforms on, and they were filthy from this train ride. And people were cheering us all the way through because they thought we were American heroes, that we had just come back from the front because we were so grimy looking.
But at what stage did you think, I can write a play, or did you always think that?
It was after about 10 years of writing for radio and then television when I said, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. I think I can do better. But I was very much afraid to make that first attempt because I had so many friends who wrote their first play that closed in two nights and never went back to it. I fought myself night and day to make sure that this wouldn't fail.
So it was your first play was a success on Broadway?
Well, I'll tell you the interesting story. I think the man who helped make it a success was Noel Coward, because the play opened to modest reviews, some good, some bad, but no one came to buy any tickets. And they put the closing notice up, and we were going to close on Saturday night, and there's a very famous agent in the States named Irving Lazar, who died recently, but he was a good friend of Noel Coward, and he took Noel Coward to see the play that night because they had seen everything else in New York, and Noel liked to see every play in New York before he went back to London. He saw the play, then went to a restaurant where a famous columnist for the newspapers came up to him at dinner and said, well, what'd you do tonight in town, Noel? And he said, I saw the funniest play in town, Come Blow Your Horn. The next day it was in the paper, and the day after that we had a line around the block.
Such a rocketing to success. You must have felt elated, incredible.
Well, the rocket really didn't come until Barefoot, and I still didn't feel very secure. Even when I wrote the next play, which was even a bigger hit than Barefoot, which was The Odd Couple, it took me a long, long time to feel secure. I'm still not that secure, but it was enormously exciting in those days.
Record number three.
I picked this song and this particular rendition because there are three of my very favorites, my loves, in this life. One is Fred Astaire, the other is London, and the other is Gershwin. And it's Fred Astaire singing A Foggy Day in London Town.
A foggy day in London Town had me low, and it had me down. I viewed the morning with alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm.
Fred Astaire and A Foggy Day, written of course by the two Gershwins. Can we turn to your personal life, Neil Simon? Your wife, Joan, to whom you've been married for 20 years, died tragically when she was only 39 of cancer. That was in 1973.
Yes.
And that laid you, as it would, pretty low for a time, didn't it?
Enormously. I had not known what grief was until that happened because it was so unexpected, and she was such an extraordinary girl. I think one may tend to idealize the life of someone who dies young, but I never idealize her when I think about her. She just was an extraordinary woman. And when she died, I was left in charge of my two children. One was both girls, one 10, the other 14 and a half. And that really helped me get through my own personal grief. I think we helped each other. So it was an extraordinary time in the three of our lives. It brought us even closer than we ever were.
And then later that same year, you met and married Marsha Mason.
Yes, yes.
Very quickly, all within the space of a few weeks.
Yes, it was a bit of madness, I think, on my part, not because of Marsha, but to rush into a situation only months after this. But
the marriage went wrong, and part of its going wrong became the inspiration for a play, didn't it, for Chapter 2?
Yes. Well, part of its going wrong was because of my wife's death, because I think Marsha had to bear the burden of my not having really gotten rid of all the grief, so that in the first year or two, I still was attached to the memory of Joan.
But does that mean that writing for you is a kind of catharsis? You could actually get rid of the grief and the guilt and all those feelings by writing it down, and as we were saying earlier, actually seeing the funny side of it?
Yes, I'm not so sure if it's always a catharsis. In other words, one doesn't just get rid of it because you write about it. I think you do get to understand the circumstances much better. It's slowing down the process as if you're watching a film frame by frame, and you can examine, ah, this went wrong, that went wrong.
So you exorcise something.
Yes.
Do you think you've exorcised the unhappinesses of your childhood now by writing about them, as you have done rather a lot in later life?
Yes.
Suddenly do you feel better about your childhood?
No, I don't feel better about my childhood. I had a difficult childhood. I feel better about my adulthood. The earlier plays were almost, they were very light comedies, Come Blow Your Horn and Bath in the Park, which was about Joan and myself, but in a very light way. I wasn't dealing with any kind of deep thoughts that were going on between us. But I think when I was well-versed in the so-called art of playwriting, then I think I could go into the depth of what our relationships were all about, including my own childhood with my family.
Record number 4.
Well, I picked Rex Harrison. I've grown accustomed to her face. I think that I thought it was a magical piece of writing on the part of Alan J. Lerner to take Shaw's play, Pygmalion, and put it to music and to lyricize it. And you say to yourself, after you've read the play or have seen the film with Leslie Howard and Wendy Hiller, how would he ever get to sing a romantic song? It's not in his nature. And so this song is an unromantic, extremely romantic song. The minute I hear the part of the melody that is the inner part of him speaking out, where he stops and says, I've grown accustomed to her face, that's about as much of an admission as he would make to himself that he cares for her.
Like breathing out and breathing in. I'm very grateful she's a woman, and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit one can always break. And yet I've grown accustomed to the trace of something in the air, accustomed to her face.
Rex Harrison as Henry Higgins singing I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face from the original soundtrack of the film of My Fair Lady. Then there's the story, Neil Simon, of your third marriage, which reads like the plot of a good play. It's 1987, and you've been divorced for 5 years, and you go into a California department store, Neiman Marcus.
Yes.
And you fall in love, right?
Almost. I mean, the first recognition of I've grown accustomed to this face so soon. Yes, I walked through the store actually looking for a gift for a child of a girl that I had been seeing for quite some time, that that relationship didn't work out and I knew it never would. And I saw this girl behind the counter, and I found out later that she was an actress and just doing part-time work in the store. And I started to talk to her, and then there was not much left to say. And so I turned and I left, and I was heading for the garage. And I said to myself, if I go into my car now, I'll never see that girl again. And with all the courage I could possibly muster, because I've never done anything like this before, and I came back and talked to her, and she said, I really can't talk to you this way. I mean, if you're trying to talk to me socially, because I could lose my job for this. And I persisted, and just trying to get her phone number so that I could speak to her, see her again. Because I looked at her hand. I said, could I see your hand? And she showed it to me, and she said, why? And I said, I see no wedding rings there. And she said, well, I don't see any on yours either. And she didn't recognize me at first.
She
didn't know who I was. She thought I was a professor from UCLA. She thought I probably taught English Lit or something like that. Not with my New York accent, it wouldn't. But anyway, the conversation continued, and she did agree to give me her phone number. And I spoke to her the next day, whereupon she told me she got fired for talking to me. And I felt terribly guilty, and I was going to call the store. And she said, no, it's all right. I didn't really want to stay there, because I'm starting to do some more work in pictures and television and mostly in commercials.
And at what point did she discover that she was talking to or being asked out by America's greatest living playwright?
Well, towards the end of the conversation, she said, you look familiar to me. She said, do I know you? And she says, what's your name? And I said, Neil Simon. She says, oh, my gosh, I've done your works in class.
So you married a year later, but a year later you divorced.
Yes. But I couldn't get my mind off of Diane, nor the baby, whose name is Bryn. And so then we did marry, eventually, a year
later. You remarried.
Remarried. And I adopted Bryn, who's now my daughter.
Record number five.
What a Wonderful World. I had heard the song a number of years ago, and it didn't hit home until I saw Good Morning Vietnam with Robin Williams. The screenplay itself was very much the way the structure of the music was, in that it played against what was going on in the screen. In other words, when the havoc and the horror of what was going on in Vietnam, they would play some lovely melody.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you.
What a Wonderful World, Louis Armstrong. What you haven't enjoyed, Neil Simon, is the same kind of success in the UK as you have in the US. You've had your successes, but by no means the number you've had on Broadway. Why do you think that is? Well, I mean, is it frustrating to you that you haven't quite managed to cross the Atlantic in that?
Not really. It may have been in the beginning, but in the beginning I had a few plays that were successes. Barefoot in the Park was fairly successful. The Odd Couple was enormously successful. But the musicals seem to have been more successful. They're playing our song, Promises, Promises, Sweet Charity. We're all big hits in London. The plays weren't. I think one of the reasons may be, I mean, there may be some other more obvious reason, but I can't think of it, is that I write in a sort of New York idiomatic way. But I think there is a great distance in the humor. I mean, distance isn't the right word. It just doesn't get translated as well. We laugh at different things, I think.
I suppose people would point to Woody Allen, though, and say that his sharp New York Jewish wit travels across the Atlantic. So why doesn't yours?
He probably took a better boat than me. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I mean, the reverse has happened somewhat to Alan Ayckbourn, who comes to America, and I think people really appreciate his plays, but they are rarely big hits in America. They were in the beginning, just as mine were in the beginning. But the problem for both of us is that we write so many that they all can't be successes.
But what British critics seem to say is that they like your work, obviously, when it's more serious, it seems to me. They like Lost in Yonkers and Broadway Bound. They got good reviews. But they still say things like you're too influenced by the conventions of Broadway, that you like to send people home with the dramatic equivalent, one of them said, of a warming cup of cocoa. That you're kind of soft-centered. You gift-wrapped.
That may be true. I'm not so sure. It's hard to get away from writing for Broadway when that was my goal since I was a young man. And
has it spoiled you then, I suppose, they're saying?
I think so, but then they can't make up their minds on Broadway either, because the reviews of my plays are split right down the middle. If the play is very funny, the ones who aren't serious are not happy. If the play is serious, the ones who say, give us laughs, aren't happy. So,
but what I think what the British critics are saying is that they accuse you of not being true to your subject. You're not really showing the pain, the real angst at the centre of the story that you're telling, because you're going to make it soft-centred and leave the audience feeling warm and happy.
I don't think I do all the time. I think that probably is true, what you're saying, but I think certainly in Lost in Yonkers, I never thought there was a happy ending to that. And I went as far as I possibly could with that, and the same thing for Broadway Bound. There was no happy ending to that. What I try to do is write a hopeful ending, and I think people misconstrue the word happy ending, even if you take something like Barefoot in the Park, when the married couple, after 1 week, fall back in each other's arms, and everything is fine, and it's fade out. But 12 years down the line, they could be divorced. So I don't believe in endings. I believe there's the end to that piece of work, but not to their lives.
More music.
More music. Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik. Well, again, I love Mozart, and there's so much to pick from that I could have picked anything. This is as great as any, because I don't think he's written anything that was less than great.
Part of Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik, played by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. How much do you have to like the characters you're writing about?
Well, to answer that, I have to go back to Tyrone Guthrie, who was a great director in England, then came to America. And I read this piece where he was talking to Lord Laurence Olivier, when Olivier was doing a part in a play, and he came to Guthrie and he said, "I can't do this part. I just hate this man." And he said, "Oh, dear boy, you must love him. You must learn to love him." And so I usually like to make the villain in the piece the person himself. In other words, well, to put it on its most trivial form, perhaps, Felix's problem in the Odd Couple is his own problem. The world isn't doing it to him. Society isn't doing it to him. He's doing it to himself. He just refuses to be able to have a good time in life, to be as loose as someone like Oscar. I mean, if you then change that into a deeper, more serious play, in my case, let's say the Lost in Yonkers, when this young girl, Bella, who is, in a sense, a retarded young girl, is dealing with her grandmother, who is the fiercest, most I can't say words sometimes. I'm sorry, you say it for me.
Authoritarian.
See, we don't, in America, don't use words like that. She is so strong in her attitudes, but when you find out what her background is and learn that she has the inability to be able to show sentiment or love, we all sort of recognize this in somebody else in our life, if not ourselves. And so we don't necessarily root for her, but we understand her, and I think that's very important.
But is the bottom line that you've got to have a good story first? You've got to have narrative drive? Or can the characters be good enough to carry any story?
Well, the first producer I ever met who gave me the most worthwhile piece of advice was, it starts with the characters. If you don't have characters, you're building a play on sand and it'll inevitably sink. He says, you get the characters and the characters dictate what the story is because, as the Greek saying is, character is fate. And so you know that these characters are heading in a direction that they can't change, and the idea is to put enough blocks in front of them to make them at least try to change, which is what we all go through in our daily lives.
Record number 7.
One Fine Day, the aria from Madame Butterfly. I love Puccini. I don't listen to a lot of opera, but every once in a while something comes along that stays with you forever, and you need the great, great opera singers to bring it home to you.
Thank you.
aria One Fine Day from Act Two of Puccini's Madame Butterfly, sung there by Mirella Freni with the Vienna Philharmonic, again conducted by Herbert von Karajan. So, Neil Simon, we prepare to cast you adrift and leave you to your fate on this desert island. How practical are you? Will you be able to look after yourself?
Not at all.
No.
Not in the least. I
would
last maybe the better part of an afternoon.
What about psychologically, though? Will you survive, do you think, on a desert island, or would you go into terminal decline without people?
Oh, yes, I would, after a while. It's why Los Angeles seems like the desert island that I was cast away on, and I have to go back to New York quite often to see people. I try to find people on the street just to walk by them, and there's almost nowhere to go in Los Angeles to find people. You generally have better conversations at a red light when your two cars stop. And no, I would need some people on a desert island just to complain to.
But people apart, I wonder what you would miss most.
What I would miss most? Mm. Life. Everything about life. I mean, if you just look at my work, then you know that I'm writing about people in conflict. And I just love that whole idea, because they have a way of working things out.
Last record.
The last record. Peggy Lee singing Is That All There Is? I'm not quite sure why I picked this one, except that it surprised me when I heard it, and especially when I heard who the writers were. I think their names are Lieber and Stoller, who back in the 60s, I guess, wrote Elvis Presley kinds of songs. But when I heard it, I thought it was very Brechtian, very extremely pessimistic idea for a pop song. Is that all there is? No matter what she finds in life, it's not good enough. She thought there would be much more to it, which at times I think we all think about in our disappointment.
Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all.
Peggy Lee singing the Lieber and Stoller song, Is That All There Is? Pretty pessimistic ending, though.
Very, very. That's why I like it.
There's a depressive in there trying to get out, is there?
Well, I like it aired, yes.
Now, if you could only take one of your records.
Well, I'll surprise myself, I guess. I would take Fred Astaire singing A Foggy Day.
And Thoughts of London Town.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to choose a book. The Bible and Shakespeare are waiting for you on the beach. What one book would you like us to place on top of those?
Because I said I'm not very pragmatic or very practical about things, I would need something that would not make me happier there, but would help get me off the island. So I would need a book called How to Build a Boat. But since I don't think I could build the boat, I think my preference would be How to Swim Great Distances. Except since I can't do that either, I would need a book called How to Swim, because I can't swim at all.
You can't swim.
Not a stroke.
And what about your luxury? Something totally impractical. It can't be of any practical use whatsoever.
Well, I was going to pick an ice pick to help open the coconuts, but I can't use that, I see now. So I think I would pick a musical instrument that I could learn, because I can't play anything, and I'd probably pick the harmonica, a large one, and that I could play any number of kinds of music. So one that has that little handle on the end of it that quivers and gives you variations.
Neil Simon, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. I had a wonderful time.
Thank you. Thank you.